pase, pierna derecha, directo al arco, golazo, golazo.
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Tuesday, April 30th, 2019. I'm Kevin Larame, joined by Dwayne Mullins, as always. Joining us today on the line, staff writer for The Athletic Soccer, but more relevant to today's show, author of The Sound and the Glory from ECW Press, a voyage into the Seattle Sounders from their beginning to their championship, Matt Pence. How you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on, guys.
No worries, Matt. I think my first question for you is, how long was this book in your mind, and was this something that came about after the Sounders won the 2016 championship, or were you just a victim of good fortune by having them win the title for you to wrap the book up?
So the book had probably, well, a book had been probably in the back of my mind for a long time. I've always been a big reader, so that was a long time career goal. And I probably had sort of a vague idea on something that I could do with the Sounders to sort of apply my reporting there. But it wasn't until after that season that I decided to kind of go back and write it in that way, just because that season had so much going on. It had compelling characters. It had a lot of drama. It just felt like such a good little standalone sort of piece that I could really build around. So, yeah, so I ended up having the good fortune of covering the championship season for the Seattle Times. So I had a lot of background reporting, a lot of notes that I could flesh out. But I hadn't decided to actually go and write the book until after they won the championship.
All right, so fair enough. We were talking to Joshua Cloak a few months ago, and he actually was writing the book, so he was very nervous the day of the 2017 final that he was going to get the proper ending because he wasn't sure how to wrap it up beyond that. Well, speaking of that book, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of books written on Major League Soccer. Yours, Joshua's, Baudour wrote one a few years ago. Why do you think that is, and do you think that it's a ripe league to have more books like this in the near future?
Yeah, I just think it's the casual interest still really being at an early stage. I mean, you see that in the TV ratings for the league, that they still really need to sort of tap into a little bit more mainstream of an audience if it is to really take off and become the league that a lot of people want to see. So I think that that's sort of the simplest example. I mean, the book marketplace, like everywhere else, you just kind of have to be able to prove that this is going to sell. And for a long time, that was a tough sell to make. So I think that that's just naturally going to change if the league continues to grow and interest continues to develop. And I'm glad that ECW was willing to take a chance on my book and really believe that there was an audience out there for it.
Now, Matt, well, one of the interesting aspects of writing a book as well from a journalist standpoint is you go back through your notes and you go back through games that you covered and moments and controversies. While you were doing the research and going back through your notes, is there anything that happened that you remember that actually surprised you? Anything surprised you from your own notes while getting ready for the book?
I think it was probably two different things. The first one just being the extent of Clint Dempsey's heart condition, because it had been pretty obvious towards the end of that summer, because he ended up getting shut down halfway through that year because of an irregular heartbeat. It had been pretty obvious a couple weeks before that something was going on, but in the course of my reporting, I was able to kind of figure out that they had been concerned about this really going back to the preseason, to the point that he had had a chip implanted in his chest to monitor his heartbeat. So this had really been a scary long-term thing that I wasn't quite aware of the extent of, because Clint, somebody really keeps to himself and wasn't too open about opening up about that. So it really required some wider reporting to figure out what was going on there. Another one was just sort of this standalone scene that I had heard about this, sort of through the grapevine, but I wasn't actually at the game. But the scene where Nelson Valdez, in Orlando, who had a really tough year, the Paraguayan striker just hadn't scored all year, was getting blasted on social media by fans for his inability to score, first and foremost by former Sounder Eddie Johnson, who was sort of making fun of his high salary and saying that the Sounders should have paid him instead. So you go to Orlando, and Valdez figures out that Eddie Johnson's in the hallway wanting to talk to some of his old teammates, and he tries to run out in the hallway and sort of confront him, and he has to be pulled back by his teammates. And that was another one that I was sort of aware that something had happened, but being able to fill in those details and kind of have a fun little scene like that was part of the process for sure.
Of course, the win in 2016 makes for a great ending, or a great, at least, storybook ending for the book. But what else really caught your attention, positive or negative, controversy or glory? What else really inspired you with the Sounders for this book?
Yeah, I think that it was just that year felt like it was a very transformative year in the club's history, because you had Ziggy Schmid, who was probably, even now, still probably the single most influential sort of figurehead when it comes to how the club was formed and the early successes that they had. And so midway through 2016, there had been a lot of tension with him and general manager Garth Lagerwey, who had come in the year prior, and just sort of their vision for the future and how they were going to build the club, and just two very proud guys. And I think that all that kind of came to a head. And towards the middle of that year, Schmid ends up getting fired, and Lagerwey was sort of given the keys to a little bit more control. You could even still see the impact of that today with how the team is built, and Lagerwey kind of being the one that calls the shots a little bit more. So just some of those personality clashes. You had Dempsey involved. You had Nicholas Lodero coming in as the team's sort of biggest money signing of all time. There are just a lot of those little pieces and those sort of like big personality narrative clashes that I think kind of cried out for somebody to document it in that way.
Well, yeah, you mentioned, like, you know, from a storytelling perspective, the arc was written for you with Ziggy Schmid, the most influential figure in Sounders history, Sounders MLS history anyway, you know, getting fired midway through that season, and then them going on that late charge that ended, of course, with the penalty kick victory at BMO Field. Talk a bit more about Schmid, who, of course, we've lost in the last year or so now. How important was he to the book, and how important was he to soccer in Seattle and, you know, America as a whole?
For sure, yeah. Yeah, not only was he the most significant person, in my opinion, in sort of the modern history of the Sounders, who was also probably the single most important person for this project coming together. When I had first started kicking the book idea around and figuring out what access I could get and just trying to sort of wrap my mind around it, I had hit up Ziggy and asked if I could come and just kind of hang out with him for a couple days down in Southern California, where he had been living, and just kind of talk to him about the project, see if he wanted to get involved, see what kind of access he'd give me. We really just kind of hung out for a couple days. He was wide open about everything. He was just really, he was open about what had happened, but he wasn't vindictive really in any way. He just sort of wanted to tell his side of everything. And that's really where the ball started to roll, was knowing that I had all this additional context now that this was how I was going to be able to move forward. So I can't really thank him enough for that, really, even covering the team. I started covering the team when I was still, it was probably like 25, pretty early in my career and unestablished, but he was also very, he was always very generous with his time, and really took it upon himself to help me sort of learn the game a little bit more and see it in a different way. So for my career, he's been huge, and I think that my story is just one of many in U.S. soccer. You saw that when he passed away, all the different people on social media that were talking about the impact that he had, not just on the field, but off the field too. And especially for a sport that's still continuing to grow and trying to find a foothold here, having sort of a figurehead like him that was willing to go above and beyond to teach people the game and share his passion, I think was pretty remarkable, and I think that he definitely left a lasting impact on the game here in the U.S.
Having read both your book and Joshua's book, I can't recommend enough to MLS fans to read both as kind of a book, and you know, the reason is, of course, that both those two teams played those back-to-back years. taking a step away from the book for a little bit now and taking hindsight into account, how important were those two back-to-back finals against those two teams to creating this narrative and sort of maybe driving this league into the next level? I think that Toronto-Seattle back-to-back final, in my mind anyway, and I'm coming from a Toronto perspective here, was really a transformative moment in the league in terms of the next level of where this league was going to get pushed. Those two teams really helped push it there, and then Atlanta maybe tipped it over the cliff last year.
Yeah, for sure. And it's funny that you referenced Josh needing Toronto to win the 2017 final, because for me, it actually worked out well for me too, because it was kind of the opposite, because the manuscript was done, and like I had already reported it all out, and I'd kind of have it be the sort of standalone one-season thing. But if the Sounders go and win back-to-back championships, all of a sudden it's kind of going to look a little bit weird. So why are you focusing all of this first year versus the second? And I really didn't have time to rewrite it all. So for me, having them make it back and play the same team but lose was kind of the perfect epilogue. So I know the Sounders fans weren't particularly happy about that. But for me personally, that kind of worked out. To get to your point, I agree that actually probably even the last three MLS Cup finals now has kind of been very emblematic of how the league changed. I tried to be pretty clear in the book that I think that Toronto and Seattle really set that blueprint for how a lot of successful expansion teams have come in since, and really how the league has been able to transform itself as a whole. So to have those be the two teams that made it back to back to show that success off the field can pay dividends on the field, I think that was significant. And then yeah, in Atlanta just kind of really upping the ante and showing sort of what was possible and even that sort of next new age of MLS, and really showing what both TFC and Seattle are going to have to do now to raise their own games to match that. These last couple of years have been really interesting in that way. And I'll be interested to see how that works out this year, whether that's LAFC maybe being another one of those new expansion teams that looks like they're going to set a higher bar here.
Speaking of LAFC and today's MLS, a battle of heavyweights this weekend finished with a 1-1 draw between Seattle and LAFC. Seattle having a great debut of the season this year, and Jordan Morris is one of the key reasons. How do you quantify a successful season in 2019 for the Seattle Sounders, having gone through the 2016-2017 season, and then last year, the difficulty and the heartbreaks in the playoffs? How do you quantify success for a team that's not necessarily have done it all recently, but they've almost won it all? So how do you create another type of successful season this year?
Yeah, I think that just given that they've checked off almost every single box, having won MLS Cup, they won a Supporters Shield, they won 4 U.S. Open Cups at this point, I think sort of the last frontier for them, and granted maybe the CONCACAF Champions League, if they can get back there and make a run, that's kind of a target for all of the bigger MLS teams, I think. But for this year, I think that not only making it to MLS Cup, but hosting it here, is sort of probably the next step for them in sort of building that local casual interest and continuing to build that buzz. It's one thing to go and win a championship, but I mean, as I'm sure you guys experienced in Toronto, just kind of having that event there and just sort of the awareness that builds for the city sports fans that really taps into just beyond that little soccer bubble, I think that can make a big difference. And I think that the Sounders are a team that's very built to win right now. They have a lot of guys in their primes. They sort of consolidated their roster. They're looking at this as being sort of maybe their year to go and kind of do it all. So I think that's a very high bar to set for a successful season. But I think for them, that's sort of that next frontier, is to be able to host the championship game here. And given how important seeding is now, their hot start can make a big difference.
The Sound and the Glory, how the Seattle Sounders showed Major League Soccer how to win over America, by Matt Pence, available from ECW Press. Now, before we say goodbye for today, Matt, it is an interesting year over the last couple of years, even in soccer media, sports media, and The Athletic Soccer. You're now a staff writer for The Athletic Soccer. What can you tell us on their national expansion of coverage for this year with yours truly?
Yeah, I think it really represents just sort of an unprecedented investment in soccer coverage in North America, just with the scale. I think we have six or seven full-time writers now, a full-on national writer in Paul Tenorio, a women's national team writer in Meg Linehan, and then sort of these different writers all around the country. And I think that having that size of staff, I can't even remember in sort of the heyday of media 5-10 years ago that there was ever a place that was investing quite that heavily in full-time staffers. Because I think part of what was maybe a little bit lost in how The Athletic was sort of building its soccer coverage is we kind of had a little trial run where a lot of us were on part-time. We were contributors, but we were still having to freelance on the side. I personally was waiting tables for a little bit while I was finishing the book.
Oh, I think we just lost Matt for a second. Matt, are you there? There we go. Well, I think we lost Matt, but it was a pleasure to talk to Matt. Hopefully, let me just double check here. Yeah, we lost Matt for today. But Matt, thank you very much for your time today. Again, The Sound and the Glory, available through ECW Press. And go to Matt's Twitter feed, where he actually talks openly about how difficult it was over the last few years, having to juggle real work, like journalism is not real work, outside work and part-time work to make our dream of doing work on The Beautiful Game happen. This feels familiar, and I support Matt, and hopefully it goes well for him all year long.
Yeah. I'm sitting in a marketing office, and you work in the hospitality industry. So Patreon.com. So no, it's fine, folks. But nonetheless, a lot of effort there to have them full time. I do understand The Athletic strategy. I do think they could have rolled it out a little bit better. I've been a little bit more upfront. It's difficult for people to completely comprehend, particularly when they lose their local coverage. But nonetheless, and I do wish The Athletic had hired some Canadian writers, or at least a Canadian writer in that mix as well, to sort of reflect that fact that they are very active in this country. But nonetheless, I do appreciate that they have gone with full-time jobs for soccer writers, and that's something that we haven't seen in the past. So that's what Matt was doing. But more importantly, the book is excellent. I did read it over the weekend. It is, as I said, a bookend to Josh's book, in terms of understanding the league. Both Seattle and Toronto they're interwoven now in terms of their history, right? Like, one started in 2007, the other started in 2009, so only a couple years apart. The team that started in between them is irrelevant, it's the Earthquakes. So I don't mean to be saying irrelevant, but you know what I mean? They haven't had sort of impact on the league. Obviously, and they're like almost mirrors of each other, because both of them did the whole fan thing and the engagement thing. And, you know, we joke in Toronto, one of the TIFO ideas for the first MLS Cup was "We invented you," because that was a joke on social media for a while back in the early part or the later part of the last decade. Seattle thought they invented soccer. And
did you say social media in 2007?
Yeah. I started around then too, but anyway.
But the beginning of social media, where there was like five people
back before
on it.
Back then it was more like big soccer and places that.
Like forums were social media,
pre-Reddit. They mirrored each other. Like, Seattle was the good twin and Toronto was the bad twin, right? Like, they both kind of started from the same place and started with the same ideas, and one went that way and one went that way. And suddenly, but the path kind of weaved back around and hit each other again in 2016. So it's an interesting interwoven history, and I think that it's worthwhile reading both books if you want to get a great history of MLS up to the end of what we would call the MLS 2.0 era, because I do think that we're in the MLS 3.0 era now.
Yep, I'm not going to argue with that statement. I think it's pretty accurate, especially when we're looking at this. I think we're in 3.0 and 4.0 is just around the corner. But no, it's going to continue to evolve. We'll obviously touch on the Champions League in a second, but before we wrap the show today, Dwayne, yesterday, Monday, was the North American Soccer Player of the Week reveal. I won. No, it's not a win. It's not a contest, but I thought I was going to be the only one to vote for a goalie who has two clean sheets in the same week, but apparently I wasn't. And off the top of my head, I cannot remember the last time a goalkeeper in Major League Soccer won the Player of the Week award. Evan Bush of the Montreal Impact, after 2 clean sheets in the same week, 5 clean sheets in the last 6 games, he is getting the Week 9 Player of the Week award.
See, it is difficult for a goalkeeper to do that. You basically need 2 clean sheets in the same voting period for you to have a chance. But it's even harder for a defender, right? So it is a rarity. Usually it's the Brace of the Week award, as we jokingly call it, speaking of which you might want to.
And I thought Quesada was going to win because he scored 2 goals for New England.
Yeah, exactly. Hat trick, it's almost automatic unless there's 2 hat tricks in the same week. Nonetheless, keep an eye out. There might be a Canadian Premier League one starting up from the same people. Just a little inside baseball there. But nonetheless, it's a good honor for a guy that I know you've been pretty high on for a while. And more importantly, however, it's reflective of what was a very, very good week for the Montreal Impact, who, you know, if I'm power ranking Canadian teams right now, I'm putting them maybe number one ahead of TFC in terms of the overall power ranking. Maybe I'm going to put, York 9 third, because I don't think it's the Whitecaps.
Oh, and the other important thing for Montreal, and I think it has to be noted, 7 out of 9 games without Nacho Piatti. So Nacho Piatti played 2 games this year. Not bad.
Yeah.
And 17 points without Piatti. Anyways.
Yeah, and if he can get healthy, then that's great news.
Bonus.
Bad news if he can't get healthy. But if he can get it.
The training today, training report brought to you by Tristan Lamour. Tristan, a friend of the show here, of course, personal friend, of course, was on Twitter today saying that Nacho Piatti was training. He didn't take part in the entire training. And it wasn't because he was still injured. He wanted to ease back into training, but apparently he looked real good today, if that is any indication of what's going to happen in the weekend. Before we say goodbye, we've got 2 minutes left, Dwayne, for today. The Champions League, it's back. There's only 5 games left total in the Champions League in 2019. Tottenham, Ajax today at 3 p.m. in the first leg of the semifinals. And tomorrow, Barca, Liverpool.
Yeah, and I'm far less stressed than I would have been otherwise. Look, Spurs put, the fear of God into Ajax by losing on the weekend, and part of that sort of rumble to the finish for the top 4 teams there. Look, I can't help but, I think that everyone is leaning towards Ajax in this tie, which makes me think that Spurs is probably going to win.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
Harry Kane's going to score at home. And,
Cinderella's
going to turn back into a pumpkin one day.
Well, sometimes it's Cinderella either way here. Let's face that.
True. Okay. The bigger Cinderella of the two, Ajax, their carriage is going to turn back into a pumpkin, and it's 5 to midnight. I think it's going to be maybe this time around. We'll see. I don't know. Ajax.
Yeah. Well, the evil stepmother is still in the competition, though, right? So.
Barcelona. Yeah. So the evil stepmother is going to win it all. It's going to be Barcelona. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But we'll be back tomorrow with more coverage of the Champions League. We'll talk about today's game. We'll talk about the world of football with a soccer perspective, about the Canadian Premier League. And again, if you liked our Canadian Premier League coverage last week, it was a free preview. This week, it's going to be Thursday on the Two Solitude Soccer Podcast. We will have League One Ontario Commissioner Dino Rossi for his annual State of the League conversation, and we will talk about the first 3 games in the history of the Canadian Premier League, with tomorrow's game included in the discussion on Wednesday. But as always, you can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute, me at Kev Larme, of course, and the show at Soccer Today SPN. Until next time, thanks to Matt Pence. Go get his book, The Sound and the Glory, through ECW Press. And until tomorrow, have a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.